Today's date is March 25th, 2009. We're at the Amelia Island Museum of History. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing J. Michael Keating, Jr., date of birth February 10th, 1939, place of birth Passaic, New Jersey. My name is Robert Hamer, and I will interview Mr. Keating on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will be operating the recording equipment. During the course of the interview, we'll be discussing the following subjects. What was your period of service? During which conflicts did you serve? What was your rank? And where did you serve? But first, let's start, Michael. What was your motivation for joining the Air Force back in May of 1963?
Well, by that time, I was 24. I had gone to undergraduate school. I had gone to graduate school. I then spent a year in a Catholic seminary and came out and it had three deferments of various kinds, and I knew that the service would be after me, and I was perfectly willing to serve my time. I was also evidenced by the litany I just recited, somewhat at odds and ends about what the hell my career was going to be and
sure.
what my future would hold. My family had long been involved with the Air Force. My father was an Army Air Corps flight surgeon in World War II. My brother was a career officer, pilot for the Air Force. My brother-in-law was a career officer. Even my sister had served as an officer in the Air Force in meteorology.
Mm-hmm.
So I had plenty of contacts with and a lot of respect for both what they had done and their tales of the life itself, so I decided I would apply for OTS in the Air Force. And yes, it would be a longer period of time, but I was in no hurry at that particular point. I was unmarried then and was still sort of searching for just what it is I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
Sure, that's great.
A search which has continued ever since, pretty much.
Totally all.
So you enlisted in the Air Force. What was your first duty station? Where did you go to basic?
It was to Lackland in San Antonio.
Okay.
And that was the 90-day wonder school, and did the 90-day business there, and graduated, became a second lieutenant.
Second lieutenant.
Yeah.
And where did you go from there?
From there, I went to the basic Air Force Intelligence School at Denver at mm-hmm. Lowry Air Force Base. Was there for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I went to the Officers Intelligence course at Fort Holabird in Baltimore, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And was there for 6 months. And after that, went to the Defense Language Institute at Monterey in the Korean language for a year.
Okay.
And then went to Korea for about 14 months, and then a tour in Japan for 3 years, and that was my career.
Okay. Why was it intelligence, your selection?
Yes.
Okay. And why? What was your motivation for that? Why, instead of flying or any other?
Well, I wasn't interested in flying. I have vision problems,
okay.
And wasn't particularly crazy about flying. So I was going to do something else. And
sure.
Intelligence seemed to... I don't even know whether I requested it, but that worked out fine.
Felt that was your focus.
Right.
So what were some of the techniques that you learned in intelligence school? What was it?
Well, the basic Air Force intelligence school at Lowry was sort of to give you a sense of the process, what it is that an intelligence officer in a typical Air Force combat unit would do to service the pilots and crews that were flying. We had to learn how to look at photographs and mm-hmm. tell what was there, translate photographs into radar predictions so that people who were flying missions against a particular site would be able to recognize from the radar what the targets would look like, and a broader understanding of the organization and general mission of the intelligence function within the Air Force family.
Sure. What were some of the experiences that you had while you were doing that, in analyzing some of the mapping and radar, things like that?
Well, I got to do more flying than I had ever done
in
my life, not flying, but in airplanes. Because
travel.
What they would do is the place that we persistently bombed was, mm-hmm. was Cheyenne, Wyoming. So we would fly up along the eastern ridge of the Rockies up to Cheyenne, both to take pictures and analyze pictures and to prepare radar predictions.
Sure.
And the interesting thing about that, of course, is on the east edge of the Rockies, and I'm sure the pilots enjoyed this a lot. They were the old buses, the C-54s that they used for these things, and they would get buffeted pretty wildly from the turbulence off the mountains.
Sure.
They seemed to find the most turbulent places for all of us to experience. But I didn't mind it, and I really enjoyed it, and it was very different than now.
So these would be like bomb runs that you would be, so simulated bomb runs, or?
Well, they weren't necessarily simulated bomb runs, but they were, sort of to give us a sense of the difference between the real thing, mm-hmm. The photographs, and the radar,
sure.
and how you try to get them all to match together. Another thing we did, which I thought was fascinating, they took us down to the Colorado Iron and Steel plants so that you would be able to see what was on the ground mm-hmm. related to the photos from the air,
sure.
and what these things were that were down there, and how they might look on the ground, and would then give you a better idea when you looked at the photos of it, of what was there and what elements were there and what was part of this kind of process, and how you would then translate that into radar
sure.
images. So that was all of that was brand new to me and was quite interesting, I thought.
Very, very good. Now, how large was your group that you did this with, your intelligence group?
I would guess about 25.
25,
yeah. You know, and most of them were shaved tails, like myself, new to the business. There were maybe one or two older guys, but most of us were shaved tails.
Anybody that you got friendly with? Any buddies that you hung out with?
Well, in fact, while I was at Lackland, I had befriended another member of the class who came from Florida and had a graduate degree and was very compatible, and we sort of got together. And when we went to Denver, we and another fellow took an apartment there together, and that worked out very well. And interestingly, that individual and I then went to all of the same schools mm-hmm. together, went to Korea together, mm-hmm. and he went to Japan to a different outfit, but I went to Japan too.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was in Japan, I had gotten married between Korea and Japan,
mm-hmm.
and when my wife and I went to Tokyo, he was also stationed near Tokyo. We got together, and my wife taught at the international school,
mm-hmm.
and she, being very enthusiastic about the marital condition, introduced him to one of her fellow teachers at the international school, whom he married.
Mm-hmm.
He left the Air Force a year before I did, and then went back to the States and became a Foreign Service officer.
Yeah.
He adopted a Korean daughter shortly thereafter. When we got out of the Air Force and went back to Washington, and I ended up in law school, we decided, having had one child of our own, that babies was not our specialty, and we adopted a Korean son who was 5 and a half when he came from Korea. Those two were married last January in Key West, which is sort of a remarkable story. And they're both beautiful, wonderful kids, very much in love, and they live around the corner from us here in America.
No, how old are they now?
My son is 36, and she's about 32.
Wow, that's wonderful. That's a good story.
So that's probably my best benefit out of Air Force life, because certainly we would not have adopted a Korean youngster if we hadn't gone through all of that business of Korea.
Of course, you stayed in touch with your buddy all the time.
And we stayed in touch, and he was off, and we were in different places, but we would get together every so often. They mm-hmm. never really made contact in any meaningful way, the kids, during that time. But as my wife began to get more anxious as my son got past the 35-year mark, he and Sally, who was Sonmei's mother, decided to take one last crack at it, and so they did. And after all, she had brought mother and father together, and I was the best man at their wedding in Tokyo 40 years ago. So it was sort of a wonderful dividend of
that's great. That's military a great story. Service. How about in a leadership kind of capacity? Was there anybody that was like a role model for you while you were in the military there? Anybody that impressed you like that?
Not so much there. That was a pretty, it was a larger class. They were mostly our peers. It was nice to sort of test your own ability and whatever with your peers. Mm-hmm. But there weren't any outstanding role models there. There were more at the school in Baltimore, mm-hmm. Which had a mix of both young officers and older fellows. Mm-hmm. We had a couple of like colonels and a major and a couple of captains and a handful of lieutenants. And because we lived in we lived on base in a BOQ, and in fact we lived in a BOQ that was built during World War I, mm-hmm. in which my grandfather had spent some time while serving in the United States Army many years ago. So there was a great spirit of camaraderie, and because it was an all service class, there were members of the Army, Navy, etc., who with whom there was this sort of engaging rivalry and whatever. And because all the senior officers in the class were Air Force, they sort of stepped forward, and there were some wonderful guys there. And I haven't kept in touch with them, and I'm not even sure I remember their names, but I just know that they were a very impressive bunch of people who, showed no airs and were perfectly natural and approachable and accessible and were just fun human beings and very tolerant of our naivete and rawness. And that was really quite a nice experience. And we'd sit around at night with a beer outside in the front lawn of this rundown, wretched BOQ and cook steaks and hamburgers and whatever. And just had a pretty wonderful time, and created our own officers club, if you will.
Good for you. Good. What about your experiences in career in Japan when you were there? It changes, but anything that impressed upon you? You were several years beyond, say, World War II and the Korean War, but anything that sort of took you back when you were there?
I had led a pretty sheltered life. I had been going to school until I was 24, and really the 2 years by that time I was in the Air Force, I'd just been going to school some more, and it was all sort of same as what was before, only a slightly different environment and slightly different subjects. But it was the first time, I was in Canada briefly and maybe in Mexico briefly, but I'd really never been in a foreign country to speak of. And so flying off to Korea was really sort of a pretty special thing. And, of course, having had a year in preparation for that, because the faculty at the Monterey Language Institute, they were all native-born Koreans. We spent 6 hours a day, 5 days a week for a year learning how to speak Korean. They introduced us to its food, to its culture, its history. And really, we were totally immersed for a year. So it wasn't with just the usual expectation of going to a foreign place, but it was going to a foreign place for which I was really very differently and well prepared.
Sure.
So it was really quite exciting to first go there. And this group that I was with, the 6499th, was a very small unit. It was basically a liaison outfit with the Republic of Korea Air Force. And we were stationed on it was a little helicopter airport on an island in the middle of the Han River in Seoul. It became, I was absolutely astonished in 1988 when the Olympics were in Korea, and the opening thing, they had this jump from airplanes of, I think they were RAF, or Republic of Air Force, Republic of Korea Air Force paratroopers, or para whatever, leap out of this plane and form these units and go down. And as they went down, I said, I know that place. They were going to where the Olympic Stadium was created, which was put in place of that little helicopter airport in the middle of the Han River. It was just absolutely astonishing. But it in our day, or in the time that I was there, every spring the Han River would overflow and sort of flood everything. You were 2.5 feet underwater, and the Han River was not the cleanest river in the world in those days, and so you spent almost 3 months of your tour cleaning up after the mess and making do. Because of the liaison function, we met a lot of Korean Air Force people and their families. The commander for a period of that time lived in the economy with his wife and daughter and mother, and got very involved in the Korean community. So we had lots of contacts with both Korean military and Korean civilians. And the unit itself was, included as many Koreans who were civilians working for the Air Force as it did Air Force personnel. So we got a lot of exposure. And frankly, I just fell in love with Korea. It was an absolutely wonderful place. It was still pretty raw in those days. The Korean War was about 10 years old, or over for 10 years, but it was still pretty primitive in lots of ways. It was just beginning to kind of pull itself together economically. And it was just a fascinating place to be. And because we were on this separate island, we lived on the island, we worked on the island, we had vehicles at our disposal pretty much all the time. We were in and out of Seoul all of the time. It gave us a freedom of movement that was exceptional, and we just fell in love. And this other fellow who had gone to language school with him, when we have leave, we would go all over the country. Sure. Really drove everywhere and spoke enough language. I mean, even though we've been doing it for a year. And their Korean language is one of those languages that has all different degrees of formality. And of course, we learned the most formal form of the language, and as often it elicited giggles rather than necessarily much response. But it was enough to be able to eat and drink and get around and do what we needed to do that. And we had vehicles to do it in, and we were young and no attachments. So it was really kind of a special time. I really loved Korea.
Good. Have you been back at all?
Well, we went back several. My wife and I both went back several times from Japan when we were stationed there for 3 years. And again, we just she loves it as much as we did, which is why we ended up with a Korean son and now Korean daughter-in-law, and presumably Korean grandchildren sometime real soon if we're lucky.
That's wonderful. Michael,
ready?
Michael, let me ask that from May of '63 to January of '70, your time in the Air Force was sort of a turbulent time in the United States. While you were in the military, were there any special alerts or things that you need to be aware of as an intelligence officer, anything that came up that might have been of interest?
Well, the intensity with which everything was watched and the eagerness with which information was collected obviously ratcheted up as the Vietnamese conflict unfurled. And there was, particularly because there was uncertainty of the extent to which the Chinese were involved in what was really going on in Vietnam, and because we were in Korea, which is a great listening post for what's going on in China, we spent a lot of time retrieving material from mostly from intercepts, but sometimes just from playing radio broadcasts within mainland China about what was going on politically and what if any relationship they were willing to deal with publicly in regard to what was going on in Vietnam. And we got that both from our own from transcripts of our own interceptions as well as transcripts from interceptions by the Republic of Korean Air Force folks. And that's really what we did. Our function there was to work with the Korean Air Force to make sure that we were all working together and that we had access to what they had and they had access for all practical purposes to what we had. They had a lot more than we had in some respects, but obviously we had a lot that they were interested in as well. And at the time, Chung Pak-hee was the strong man. I guess he was president in term, but he was really pretty much the dictator of South Korea. Ran a very taut ship, but their military was incredibly open to us and very cooperative. So we got a lot of decent information, mostly on China.
Any world leaders come to visit while you were assigned?
Well, President Johnson came to visit while we were there, and I'll never forget, as I indicated, we were stationed on this island in the middle of the Han River in the middle of Seoul, and as a result of that, they had pretty good control over access to the island, so that when the security people came from the United States and all the services and South Korea to plan for the security for the trip, they came to this island where we had a decent sized conference room, or the Korean Air Force had a decent sized conference room, and everybody got together to plot out what everybody would be doing and who would be responsible for what. And what was absolutely hilarious to us was while the Secret Service came in two jeeps and went inside, when they came outside, one of their jeeps had gone. It had been stolen, gone out over the causeway with an MP post at either end, and somehow. So they knew that they had a long road to hoe in terms of their security. And also, interestingly, on this island, which was about, I guess, 1¾ mile long and maybe 1/4 mile wide. At one end of it, there was a fairly prominent hill, maybe a few hundred feet high, and on top of that, I'm not sure what it was originally, but it had become the house of the commander of the unit that I was attached to there. And it was surrounded by, and this is just absolutely wonderful for intelligence purposes, by refugee farmers from North Korea. So, you know, it was sort of an incongruous mix anyway. But for a dozen years anyway, or 10 years, there had always been a fairly amiable relationship between whoever was the commander and living in that hut and the villagers around it, who were a pretty primitive sort, but they had their rice fields there and were farming and whatever. Until a commander who had really been there for 7 or 8 months by the time I got there, and who was serving out his, I think it was 13-month tours in those days. And he had conceived that these people were not reliable. And so he determined that, and because of their renown as thieves, he was concerned that he and his hut would be subjected to their thieving activities. So, after years of absolutely no security around this hut, he began to build security. And first he put up a modest fence. And for the first time, somebody came over the fence and stole something. So he built a higher fence. And once again, it was each increment. Then he had floodlights, and then he put razor ribbon around the top of the fence. And it just became this wonderful game. And we would kind of, every morning as he came into our compound down in the heliport, we would kind of look to see whether a new adventure had occurred. About the last week he was there, he actually woke up and heard this scratch, scratch, squeak, squeak, and he got up and looked down the hallway of this little place, and there was his stove being taken out of, he saved his stove, but it was just sort of a wonderful.
Now, was it the refugees that are actually doing the?
Who knows?
I was wondering. Maybe
we suspect that it was.
But it was some of you guys doing.
No, it was not.
So there were pranks.
Cleaners. Yeah, they were there. You know, they made it a challenge. And
sure.
They were up to it.
Yeah. He didn't realize what he had done.
The unintended consequences of our.
Was there ever a time when you thought that maybe you'd be reassigned for Vietnam duty during that period of time?
Yeah, there was that possibility. Because the 6499 support group or special activities group had units all over Asia under PACAF. We were in the Philippines and Vietnam and Okinawa and elsewhere. There was a real possibility that that would occur. But actually, my closest contact with the conflict in Vietnam was procuring motorcycles out of the PX for officers in the 6499th elsewhere in Vietnam who were looking for transport but couldn't get it locally. So we would purchase them bikes and ship them off to them. In return for which, totally anonymously, and I don't know who it came from, but we got two, we being myself, got two absolutely gorgeous, the Vietnamese elephants that are brightly decorated and really quite lovely. They just sent them as a gesture of gratitude for doing that, which was very lovely. When I separated from the Air Force, I was told that I had to serve a year in Vietnam. Or actually, let's put it this way, when I first began to talk about separating from the Army, from the Air Force, there was mention that I had not served a tour in Vietnam and that I would probably have to serve a tour.
Okay.
So that sort of hung out there
right.
All the time. I'll tell you later how that worked out.
Sure. So basically, okay, so what was your rank at the time as you were getting ready to process out? What was your final rank?
Well, I wasn't ready to process out of Korea. I spent 3 years in Japan after that. I was a first lieutenant when I left Korea and went to Japan.
Right.
And then I think in February of 67, I became a captain.
Any experiences in Japan that you can recollect to talk about?
Japan was just absolutely wonderful. It was a three-year honeymoon what it was.
Okay.
Far away from wife's parents and family, and we were both young with no attachments and no responsibilities.
Sure.
She taught and didn't make a lot of money, but made some yen, and we would spend that on the economy. And I was teaching at the University of Maryland overseas, both in Korea and in Japan. And we just had a wonderful time. I fell as much in love with Japan as I had been with Korea, and they're very different. The countries and the people are very different. It reminded us a lot, as we thought about it later, of England and Ireland. You know, the Japanese, like the English, are pretty reserved and very polite, and it's hard to kind of break through that veneer, but once you break through the veneer, they can be just wonderfully friendly and encompassing, embracing. The Koreans, on the other hand, are just like the Irish. They're gregarious as hell. They love to sing. They drink like lords, and very different people. One so reserved, the other so outgoing and gregarious and wonderful. But we loved them both. We were fortunate to meet and to become students of a Japanese woman who was a teacher of Ikebana, of flower arranging. I don't know how I got dragged into it, but somehow she would come and bring flowers, and my wife's friends would come and they would take a lesson. And because our house was not much bigger than this table in those days, it was pretty hard not to be at least a kibitzer in all of this stuff. And so finally one night she just brought flowers for me as well. And I got swept up to that, and we became involved with this woman in just such wonderful ways. She adopted us, and took us into her home, and she would take us to the local baths in the evening, and just took us all over Japan. It was just a remarkable influence, really sort of a Reader's Digest, the most remarkable person you've ever met. She introduced us in ways to Japan that would just never have been possible on our own. And as I say, we weren't rich by any means, as you well know, but we had surprisingly a lot of money, enough to do what we wanted to do. And again, we had our vehicle, and the unit that I worked with was the sister unit of the Korean unit, and it too was manned and womaned primarily by Nisei Japanese who had come from the United States with MacArthur after World War II with the occupation forces and had stayed. Many of them had married Japanese women. They all lived in the economy. They knew Japan inside and out, and they too introduced us. One of them was one of the censors, the original censors of the Kabuki Theater, which is the, I don't know whether you know what the Kabuki is, but it's a very stylistic, ancient Japanese form of theater that is very colorful and great music and just an extraordinary experience. And the men play all the roles, women and whatever, and he would take us backstage and introduce us to the actors, and we'd watch them get into their gear and whatever. It was just wonderful. So we had an absolutely wonderful time in Japan. The idea for my assignment there had been originally because there was, and there still is, a very large Korean community in Japan who are maybe less so now, I don't know, but certainly then were the object of severe discrimination by the Japanese. I mean, they had no respect for Koreans whatsoever, and so they were a discontented and unhappy segment of the population. And there were thoughts about doing some operations with that population, vis-a-vis North Korea. We never got very far with that, but that was at least part of the reason that I was sent there originally, so that there was this overflow and connection, attachment in terms of both the people from both sides and the activity that we've been involved in. So it was, it was just a wonderful time. And, you know, mission-wise, what we did, again, here we had about 30 Japanese and American civilians working for the Air Force, who translated everything that the Japan Air Self-Defense Forces would give us. And, you know, mostly they gave us junk, but every so often they'd give us something pretty interesting.
Sure.
Certainly my most interesting experience in Japan was while I was with the 6499 Special Activities. This was Detachment, I guess it was Detachment 1, and the Korean Detachment was Detachment 2. The Soviet Air Force forced down a trans-world airline that had taken off from SeaTac with about 280 GIs going back to Vietnam after an R&R or some duly assigned people. And they forced it down because, as near as we could tell, trans-world, in order to save some time and money and fuel, began to, in the Great Circle route, they'd come out of SeaTac and then curve up and over and come down across Sakhalin and whatever, and they were encroaching on Soviet airspace, and the Soviets were getting very angry. Or at least the commander of the airbase in northern Sakhalin was getting very annoyed. The airfield was Borovostok. And they went up and set up some MiGs and forced this airplane down. And it landed on this prime, principal, tactical Air Force base for the Soviet air defense. And, of course, the guys didn't know what was going on. They had no idea what the heck was going on. And they got on the airliners, onto the tarmac, and there's this long, long wait of an hour, 2 hours while they're waiting for something to happen. And finally, they get told to open the doors, and they open the doors, and on comes this delegation of Soviet officers who are going up and down the thing, and they're looking for the senior man on board. Hmm. And it turns out that the senior man on board is a U.S. Air Force captain dentist who has been on active duty for about 90 days and is going to Vietnam. So they take him off the airplane and they bring him down. And they have very limited English capability. And he, of course, has absolutely no Russian capability, and he has really very little idea what the hell he's supposed to do and whatever. All he knows is somebody somewhere said name, rank, and serial number, and that's, you know, and so he gave name, rank, and serial number and just, you know, hung on.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, questioned him, and he kind of, and again, he just was at sea as to what he could say.
Sure.
And frequently he was at sea at what was being asked of him because he just couldn't understand what was going on. And meanwhile, at the plane, the Russians clearly had not thought this through, and so they didn't really know what to do with these people. They couldn't take them, and they wouldn't take them off the plane in this high-level tactical air defense field and just let them wander around.
Sure.
So they kept them on the plane, and then they finally rolled in this great big 2.5-3-foot-wide cheese and a great big circle and kind of rolled it down the aisle for people to pick at and eat and whatever. After about 4 days, they decided to, maybe this wasn't such a great idea. And, we sort of figured that Moscow must have gone ballistic.
Sure. Yeah.
When they heard that this guy on his own initiative, and we're pretty sure that that's what happened, had pulled this plane down. So, after 4 or 5 days, they finally shoved this piece of paper in front of the captain and say, you know, sign this. And as best as he could figure out, what it was a statement saying that the Russians were not liable if anything happened while taking off and returning, which just seems like an incredibly non-Soviet sort of approach. But at any rate, that's as best as he could figure out what was being... And he didn't know whether to sign it, but they told him they wouldn't let him go unless he'd signed it.
Yeah, sure.
So he signed it.
Sure.
And, of course, he didn't really know what he was signing, but that's sure. Sort of what they had indicated was on the paper, and he was in no position to sort of diagnose otherwise. So they put him back on the plane, and they zipped up the plane, and they took off. And they came back to Japan. They landed on, I remember it was Tachikawa or Fuchu Air Base, one of them, and our unit got assigned to debrief them, find out what had happened. And because I was it was a weekend, and I was the senior officer around, I got sent off with their crew to go talk to them. And of course, the captain was terrified. I mean, you know, he didn't know whether he was going to be court-martialed or taken out and shot or what, because he had no idea of the military life. He had no idea of what responsibilities he might have in this circumstance. And so when we found out that he had been the spokesman for the group and had done the principal, we called him in. And I mean, the guy was literally, he was shaken. And... you know, I think we gave him a cigarette and a cup of coffee and told him, relax, it's not, you know, you don't have to, you really don't have to worry. Just tell us what happened. And he told us what happened. But the beauty of it was that all of these GIs on this plane had just come out of the BX in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
or wherever they were in the United States, had all these incredible cameras.
Mm-hmm.
And from the time they were first observed by the MiGs, they must have taken 10,000 pictures.
Sure.
Of everything, every installation, every radar, every plane, everything. And the Russians never searched the plane. They never, and of course they all assumed that before they were released, that the Russians would come on and take everything and do a thorough search. So they were cutting the seats apart and bury them in the seats and then cover it with the covers again, sure that they would...
Yes.
They just...
Let it go
and took off. And we had, you know, this airfield that we really hadn't known that much about, now became the most fully documented airfield in all of the Soviet Far East. I mean, it was just sort of a great coup, and it was just a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to be able to tell the captain, go call your wife. And tell
her, okay, everything's
and,
okay.
And everything's okay, and whatever.
That's a great story.
It was fun.
That's a great story. Let's
Okay, ready, gentlemen?
So, Michael, I see here that you retired in January 1970, so your service dates were May 1963 to January 1970. What did you do when you left the Air Force?
I went to law school.
Okay. Where'd you go?
Went to Georgetown Law School in D.C. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was going to go to Columbia. I'd been accepted at Columbia, and we had lived in New Jersey, both my wife and I. And we had family there, and they could have helped support us and whatever, because one of the results of our wonderful time in Japan is that we came home with pretty much with very little of anything. And so we intended to live in just in Jersey and go commute into Columbia. But that was in 1970, if you will recall. That was the spring in which the bombing of Cambodia occurred, and Columbia just kind of went crazy. They occupied the administration offices, and when I went to talk to folks about financial matters, I had to crawl over bodies of slovenly bearded young men and women who were making their point, and there was talk of Columbia being shut down. I had also been accepted at Georgetown. I knew that the protesters would not shut down Georgetown, or that Georgetown would not be shut down by protesters, while I wasn't so sure that Columbia wouldn't be shut down by protesters. So I called Georgetown, and they accepted me for the September semester. So I went into Georgetown then. And my wife had taught it in D.C. for a number of years before we were married, so she had ties there. Have family thereabouts, so it was okay. It was a little scary because we came home. My daughter was made in Japan, and she was born in July, and the end of July we went off to school without a job, without a place to stay or whatever. But we just figured we couldn't afford to lose another year.
Sure.
I was already by that time 30 years old, and a little long in tooth for law school, but we didn't want to give up another year, so we went to Georgetown, and that was fine. We had the GI Bill to pay most of the school bills for, so we went through that without coming out with a huge debt, like many of my peers were beginning to accumulate.
Any reflections at all about the turmoil that was on campus? There, you know, you were a retired military guy coming out. Do you have any thoughts come back to your mind seeing the protesters?
No, I mean, you were, even though we were in Japan, you were not divorced from what was going on. We had an incident in Japan that was sort of, it was disturbing. My wife, for the 3 years that we were in Japan, in addition to teaching and doing what else we did for our own pleasure, worked as a volunteer at Camp North Drake during the Vietnamese War, when soldiers were badly wounded, but they didn't really want to take them back to the States because they weren't ready to do it. They would send them to Camp North Drake, which was sort of an interim place until they could pull them together and get them in a solid enough position to then send them back to the United States. Some were sent back, unfortunately for them, I guess, to Vietnam, but most of them went back to for further medical care in the United States. And she was a volunteer there for almost the full 3 years we were there. And she would go in and write letters and do errands for guys and whatever. And we had brought her car over to Japan with us. And it was a Ford Falcon, to which she was greatly attached. And it was an older one. I think it was about a 1960 or 59 model. And in the sea voyage over, it had picked up a lot of rust, and it had, you know, rust spots all over it. And in 67, I guess, the end of 67, we went out and got some flowered decals and put them on a car to cover the rust spots. Well, a few months later, Eugene McCarthy ran in the primary, and there was all this stuff and talk and whatever, and pro-war and anti-war and whatever. And one day she was driving in, and the MP stops her and says, "You can't come on the post here." What was probably worse than anything, and got us both madder than hell, was that nobody would tell her why. They just said, "You can't come on." And the people at the sentry box didn't have any idea why not. They just said, "No, you can't come on with that car." And so she went home, finally, after waiting and trying to get somebody to respond to her, and people would come and look at her and say, "I don't know, and, whatever." So we went home, and then we tracked it down, and it seems that the commander decided this was a political statement that he was not going to permit on the base because it indicated an allegiance with the leftist anti-war element, and no part of any of it. So I protested and raised hell, and nothing happened. They let her back on eventually, but it was just kind of irritating.
Sure.
But at Columbia, no, I was never ever threatened or felt threatened.
Any resentment at all as an military guy that they were protesting?
Some, but not.
Not overwhelming. So after law school, what'd you do?
I went to work for an outfit that was then called the Center for Correctional Justice, which was a small public interest law firm in Washington, D.C., which basically provided services to prisoners in the Department of Corrections for the District of Columbia. And it was brand new. It had just been funded by the Office of Legal Services. And actually, the woman who ran it, who had founded it and ran it, hired me because in my resume, I guess I had said, I'd been in Korea, and among other things we'd done, we had interrogated prisoners. She just thought that might help. So at any rate, that's what I did for a couple of summers while I was at law school. And even before, and eventually worked there full time. And we very quickly learned that, as with so many bureaucracies, you can solve an individual problem, but you can never get anybody to address the policy. So we began to experiment with different ways of trying to get people to look at policies instead of just solving this guy's problem, but leaving it for everybody else in the same or comparable mess. And that got us into looking at ways for handling grievances of prisoners in that very complex environment. And that led us into the business of mediation, that led us into the business of arbitration and those sorts of methods for dealing with conflict. And to make a long story short, after a couple of years of designing grievance procedures, we got a chance to implement some of them in prisons around the country. We became fairly expert at the business, at the use of mediation and arbitration in large institutions.
Good for you.
Began to do it in schools and elsewhere. When the Justice Department in 1978 instituted the first three neighborhood justice centers around the country, that encouraged local communities to establish centers to develop the use of mediation to deal with cases that had been brought to court in civil matters. I got to do the coordination and training for the first three, and so then spent the rest of a fairly rich and rewarding, richly rewarding. Actually, it wasn't very rich, but it was rewarding. Career in both mediation and arbitration,
right.
Doing that around the country and everything from public policy disputes to Superfund cases, a lot of commercial involvements, and serving as a master for federal courts that had found prisons and other governmental institutions unconstitutional, and for which an elaborate remedy was necessary, but the court had no interest in being a participant in the in the remedy, simply because it was outside of their expertise,
sure.
and they were so sick of this. Usually involved long, long trials, where everybody at the end of it ended up hating everybody else and disinclined to work with others. So I got appointed by judges all across the country for a long period of time to step into those kinds of things, help parties put together a remedy, and then supervise, monitor, oversee the implementation of those remedies in those systems.
Good for you.
So it was a fascinating career.
Yeah,
very
different. 80s and 90s. That was prime time for mediation. That was great.
It was very different.
When did you retire? What year did you retire?
The end of 2007.
2007. So you just retired.
Yeah.
Yeah, good for you. How did you find Nassau County and Amelia Island?
Through my son. He's in the Merchant Marine. He's a deck officer in our Merchant Marine. And he was working out of Mayport.
Okay.
And was looking for a place to buy a house and ended up here in Amelia Island and bought a house in Lakewood down in off of Sadler Boulevard.
Yeah.
Or Sadler, whatever Sadler is. Sadler Road.
Yeah.
And we came to visit him and looked around and said, wow, this is a lovely spot. And then the next thing I knew, surprisingly, that we were looking for a house. And so we bought a house about 5 years ago and came down winters.
Sure.
And last year we put our house in Rhode Island, which is where I've been housed or based for the last 30 years, on the market. And we have a contingent contract on it, and I hope to sell it this summer.
Good. Okay.
We'll be here full time.
So what kind of activities do you have in retirement? Do you golf or tennis?
I don't golf. I walk. I walk the beach here every day.
Sure.
I follow low tide. Whenever low tide is, that's when I go to walk. Unfortunately, in the summertime, that can be not so good, particularly when low tide is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But mainly, I went to graduate school in history. I taught history for the University of Maryland overseas. It was always a struggle for me to decide between teaching and history, which I love, and the law. I mean, it was not an easy choice to make. I'm glad at the end of the day I did. And I think one of the things that my time in the Air Force taught me, as well as teaching, for the University of Maryland, that I didn't necessarily want to spend the rest of my professional career in a bureaucracy, either military or academic, which is why I ended up in law school. I've forgotten where we were.
Just basically asking you what your activities were here.
Oh, right. Yeah. So what I've done is, when I retired, I was working at the time for the United States District Court for the District of Eastern California,
mm-hmm.
in a huge case involving the California Department of Corrections. And the retirement was not entirely voluntary. I'd had some medical problems. Mm-hmm. I'd had some heart episodes. It became clear that I couldn't be flying east and west twice a month, as I've been doing for the last 10 years for this case. So I gave notice to the judge that I couldn't continue this. And they put together a library for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely astonishing.
Wow.
You know, they asked me for my input and whatever, and I gave them suggestions and whatever. And the court and the people who worked with me in California put together this 40-volume library of everything I'd always wanted to read and had never had time to do, and so now I'm doing it. And I really love it.
Do you belong to any fraternal organizations or any nonprofits you volunteer your time?
Well, I have. I'm not here simply because we've been going back and forth and it's been more difficult. As I indicated to you in the telephone, I've just signed up to be a docent here at the museum.
That's wonderful. That's great.
Which I'm really looking forward to. When I was in Rhode Island, I was involved in all sorts of things. For a long time, I was a member of and president of the board of directors of Save the Bay, which is the largest environmental group in New England, mainly focused on Narragansett Bay and the Narragansett Bay estuary and its preservation, and a lot of other volunteer things, too.
Great.
And I will get involved in things down here, too. I'm looking forward to it.
It's wonderful. Well, we're about to conclude the interview. Is there anything at all that you'd like to add that we might have missed?
Crash.
register. Here, I'll get it. They just come out ultimately like that. Well, there you go.
Let me just look at. I have a list. As I said.
You ready to go back online?
You know, you had asked earlier about significant people I had seen or observed or been associated with in the Air Force, and one that I didn't mention and I want to mention. When I was in Korea, then I think Major General B.O. Davis was head of the United Nations mission in Korea. And he, as you will remember, was, I guess at that point, the highest ranking African-American officer, at least in the Air Force, and had been the head of the Tuskegee Flying Group in World War II. He was just unbelievable.
Very impressive. Mm-hmm.
We would go and occasionally participate in the headquarters briefings. I think they were every biweekly or...
Sure.
He was just a very impressive human being, smart and sharp and articulate and commanding. I mean, mm-hmm. Talk about commanding. He was just a remarkable human being.
That's great. Do you feel that the military helped shape your life?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In little ways and in large ways as well. Among other things, it gave me a sense of the inevitability of the need for that kind of an organization and
sure.
its inherent structure. A lot more patience than I would have had I been a pure academician.
Yeah.
And it also gave me a sense of confidence in who I was mm-hmm. and my ability to work, and it gave you a chance to compare yourself with others of like age, training, etc. And it gave me a lot of confidence in my ability to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. It gave me an exposure to the rest of the world that was absolutely invaluable. Just absolutely invaluable. And some wonderful personal relationships as well. So it did a great deal for me.
That's great. That's great. Well, this has been a wonderful interview. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your experiences.
You're
on behalf of the Library of Congress and the museum here at Amelia Island. Thank you so much, Michael. Great.
You're very welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.